Thank you. And thanks and perhaps apologies to the organizers. I got the email. I said, I don't do operator theory. I don't do multivariable operator theory. Wonder why I got all, why you get all, you know, it's spam, right? But I noticed who the organizers were, okay. Maybe they know more than I do, and of course, I took a look at what I was working on. Okay, I guess that would qualify as multivariable operator theory. But I will warn you that when I say lifting, I mean it in a different way than other people here, right? And also, the varieties or the semi-algebraic sets are themselves non-commutative. There's like almost nothing commutative here. Anyway, thanks. Thanks for letting me crash the party. So lifting is against star homomorphisms, right? And so there are I'm not talking about compressions, and things are not on Hilbert space, right? So the objects are C-star algebras, the arrows are always star homomorphisms, no completely bounded maps. That's not good enough. I want star homomorphisms, right? So that type of lifting. And I want to talk about one very nice example, give you somewhat painfully slow progress on one problem. So most of you will have heard about this one. If we have a map, when Kathy Olson did this, it was from the B of H to the Calkin algebra, right? But then later, a star homomorphism between C-star algebras, so B to B mod I, if you like, and the final theorem, well, in this, as far as I'm concerned, in this picture, is that if you have a contraction that's nilpotent of order n downstairs, then you can lift it to the same. A contraction that's a nilpotent of order n. And running through the history, Kathy Olson lifted from a nilpotent from the Calkin algebra to B of H, and she didn't say anything about the norm. Olson-Peterson ramped that up to lifting against any star homomorphism between C-star algebras. And if you look at their proof, the norm is not well controlled. If the norm is 1 downstairs, the norm is something like n minus 1 upstairs. Okay. Little trick with quasi-central approximate units allows you to fix that so that the norm is no bigger than 1 plus epsilon upstairs. Right? And that's how I put it, so I wrote that down in my book and then said it as a problem. I really want norm 1 to lift to norm 1. And my co-author in this, Tatiana Shulman, on her own did this in 2008. I mean, she came to me and said, "Do you have any good lifting problems?" And I don't know if I was nice or helpful or not nice, but I said, "Oh, look at my book. There's problems in there." And, you know, 6 months later, well, here you go. She got me back, though. I said, "I don't know. We're doing all these liftings and things." I said, "I don't know, it's kind of technical, but I don't know if it's very interesting. How are we going to sell this?" She said, "You really should read your book." I looked at the introduction and actually found, okay, so it's algebraic geometry in a sense. So the difficult thing in this subject is that the lifting problems tend to each have a different method, right? And we see that in this table. We have, starting at the top, the one I just mentioned, contraction, nilpotent of order n. The reason it's nice to have the bound on the norm is that you then get a universal C-star algebra associated to that relation. Right? And if you don't know or like to think about universal C-star algebras, doesn't really matter. The main point is you can lift that set of relations. And you see the credit there, now going down. If you change that to the relation being the norm x to the n is small, right, but of a fixed limit, epsilon is something less than 1 that's fixed, you can then ask, if that's what happens downstairs, can you lift that upstairs? And this also goes back to Kathy Olson kicked this off. Again, I have no idea what to say about the universal C-star algebra, and believe she was again working in the context of lifting from the Kalkin algebra to B of H, so preserving things like essential spectrum and such. And then Ackerman and Peterson went and redid that in terms of C-star algebras. And then I want to mention a few others. So here we have two things with the contractions with the same positive parts and same absolute value, and x star y equals, well, 0, y star x equals 0. It's kind of like the kind of like O2. In fact, it maps nicely down onto O2. Anyway, here Peterson and I showed that that was those relations lift. I'm guessing it's to the credit on some of these. I think I was the first here. If you add just the relation that x squares to 0, it's a huge thing to add y squares to 0, then you get the cone on M3 as the universal C-star algebra. Right? So you can think about lifting star homomorphisms out of this cone, or you can think of lifting these relations. Okay? And we'll see. Cones are very nice because they, you start with inhomogeneous relations, you go to the cone, you get homogeneous relations. And then here, a couple of others. Let's just jump down to this one. X is normal and a contraction. We know the universal C-star algebra of it. This is the spectral theorem. Okay. And no, it doesn't lift, and I mean, it's the index. Right? So on the one hand, it's really bad news because perhaps the most interesting relation in the list doesn't lift. On the other hand, how many of us put food on our table by studying the index? Okay, so if there weren't a problem, there'd be no job, right? So I want to now jump to topology, and let me say, even though I'm studying relations, some of them fairly algebraic, I'm studying non-commutative topology. So, for example, you know that a compact manifold is always an absolute neighborhood retractor. Right? You know, more than that, you get fits in Euclidean n space, there's always a tubular neighborhood of it, right? So that's not a, you use geometry to solve that, but it's a purely topological statement about the space, right? And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, is if we write down a C-star algebra by generating relations, if they're sufficiently algebraic relations, we should be able to make some topological conclusions, right? And so this, in topology, the subject of absolute retracts or absolute neighborhood retracts, essentially the problem of extending functions off of a closed subset to a larger or slightly larger set. Right? So extension problems in topology, and there, I don't know what the Latin is for generic. I'll have to learn that. Right? Anyway, it's not ad hoc, it's the other. And so theorem, you won't see it stated like this, I'm pushing together two theorems by, I don't know how, I'm not going to try, and Borsuk. All right. every contractible, compact, semi-algebraic set inside of Euclidean n-space is an absolute retractor. Okay? That's what I mean about, first of all, it's a fairly inclusive result, right? And so semi-algebraic is kind of like a variety. It's just you allow inequalities. Right? So this is part of like real algebraic geometry. All right, we're going to take, for example, pairs of real numbers that satisfy absolute value of x cubed plus y cubed is less than or equal to 1. Absolute value of xy minus x is less than or equal to epsilon. Could be 0, could be non-zero. Okay? Now, semi-algebraic sets, you actually get generated from this. You can take unions, complements, and things like that. Right? And again, you are allowed to put equals or less than equals, things like that. Right? And so, the theorem that Loge's, this guy, you guys are recording this. I'm not going to try to pronounce things. All right. What he showed, or she, don't know, is that this semi-algebraic set is in fact always an absolute neighborhood retractor. Okay. We want to study contractible semi-algebraic sets and say connected, well, would follow, contractible. We get that one way to ensure that is to stick with homogeneous polynomials in the inequalities. So I want to talk about the non-commutative analog of this. So let's start turning all the arrows around and get into a Cicero algebra result. We could say the fact that X is an absolute retract, would be if you have a surjection star homomorphism from one commutative Cicero algebra onto another commutative Cicero algebra, then you could do the following lifting with that result. Given X and Y downstairs, so self-adjoint, X squared plus, right, because I had assumed reals, right? X star equals X, Y star equals Y, and to make it a compact set, let's just make sure, let's put in X squared plus Y squared in norm is less than equal to 1, and, right? And then X squared Y minus X, Y squared, less than or equal to epsilon, then you can lift to exactly those relations. We don't expect the non-commutative analog of this to hold because we have nothing, no way. Well, I didn't. But it turns out epsilon equals zero is your only trouble. When epsilon is non-zero, if we wanted, we could take an operator x plus iy. We're talking about normals with a spectrum like this, or contained in there, lifting to a normal with a spectrum contained in there. So, of course, we see a disk. If we actually add the relation x star, that x is normal, then we're in trouble because we have basically lifting a disk. And so our surprise was to find, as long as we avoided epsilon equals zero, things went really well. Right? And we might have seen this if we'd looked back earlier. If you look at Ackerman and Peterson's paper, they actually discussed in one paper lifting a relation x to the n equals zero and lifting a relation absolute the norm of x to the n is less than or equal to epsilon. And that's, and the less than or equal to epsilon was the easier case. So we have many more examples than this, but this is the one that gets us around that trouble of lifting normal, sort of. If you have a surjective star homomorphism, and AX is a contraction, and epsilon is now fixed, but not zero, and X star X minus X X star is less than epsilon, then you can lift it to the same. You can preserve the norm and the norm of the commutator of the X X star. Not for epsilon equals zero, so something changed, so anyway. Yeah.
Like a unitary in the Kalman algebra, perhaps.
Yeah?
You can't. Okay, then.
Just take a weighted shift.
Yeah, but I want to take a unitary in the Kalman algebra, but the projection of the shift, the unilateral shift of the Kalman algebra.
Right, but I'd perturb that by a compact, and it'll be a weighted shift. With the weight slowly grow from 0 to 1. You can do anything you like, except to make them commute.
I got fooled by your notation and the hypothesis, that's all. All right,
so, again, maybe you screwed up inviting me. I don't know. Yeah. sort of a different subject, but it has all the same words, so there must be a connection. Someone said that. So you might want to cover your eyes here. So C0 of the disk, what I would call the disk algebra, but I'd be booed. So continuous functions vanishing at the identity on the disk can be written as an inductive limit of these C-star algebras that are all projective. I'll say in a second what are projective C-star algebras. Okay? So even though the disk itself does not behave like an absolute retract, it is in fact the limit of a bunch of absolute retracts. Okay? So this is what we mean by a projective C-star algebra. Everything star homomorphisms. Given a star homomorphism A to C, and as a surjection from B onto C, you can lift to a star homomorphism. That's going to imply very restrictive. So you can't have a unit, for example. But once you settle the question of units, this is basically saying that A is acting non-primitive analog of absolute extensor, and there's a theorem of Borsuk that absolute extensors are absolute retracts. Many things follow from being projective. For example, residually finite dimensional, right, as a separating family of finite dimensional representations. Right? Contractible, right, homotopic to zero. And they are beautiful expressions of the index maps in K-theory. Right? I give a talk in Copenhagen, putting the boundary back in the boundary map. you can get a situation that's much more like the situation in topology by discussing a projective C-star algebra mapping onto like a semi-projective C-star algebra, and you can get more precise in instances where you know something about how a K-theory element is realized in the quotient. You get more precise ways of lifting. Getting something in the ideal. Anyway, there's K-theory if you're into that thing. Of course, the projective itself has zero K-theory. Any invariant you want to calculate is zero. Okay. So this is unnerving, which is take the distance function to the Cantor set, like this, all right? And that's, then X will be the Cantor set written as the intersection of a bunch of nice intervals, right? X is bad, Xn is nice. Take the intersection of all the Xn and boom, you get the nasty old Cantor set, all right? We've done exactly the, so you can, this looks very similar to a few slides ago. We can say the continuous, I gotta make them, get rid of those units. Take the functions of the Cantor set that vanish at zero. You can write that as an inductive limit of universal feature algebra generated by a positive element, such that that function f applied to x makes sense. X is positive. I can apply continuous functional calculus, take the norm, perfectly good relation. It's not algebraic. But here we have, in essence, we've just, by easing up on the relation, you get nice spaces as spectrum. I find, I say it's disconcerting because I don't like seeing something that compares the a normal element, you know, the disk to the Cantor set, but that's just the way it's coming out. So, the title I wanted to put there was basically, what would Gert do? I'm actually thinking of taking orders for t-shirts. Chuck's in for two. So when I get stuck, I just, I think, what would Gert do? And so, it's a nasty old paper, but dig into it anyway. And basically, Tatiana and I had a look at the lifting of an almost nilpotent, right, in Ackermann and Peterson, and just had to retrofit that proof to work in this case. Now, what Tatiana Schulman had done the lifting of a nilpotent contraction to a nilpotent contraction, what happened, she says, she said, well, if you hadn't written your book so sloppily, I might have found the easy way to learn that lifting a contraction to, how to lift a contraction to a contraction. But instead, I asked my father, Victor Schulman. He said, oh, use M-ideals. Which, I mean, is a really weird take on anything in C-star algebras. But that was the outsider's perspective. And she went, okay. And it was just the thing. But we got stuck. We pushed it and pushed it, and we just couldn't get all the relations, so we finally said, okay, maybe we need quasi-central approximate units. Right? And so what we do is we take a lift and we keep hitting it with a quasi-central approximate unit. Not once to make the norm, you do it once to make the norm epsilon plus epsilon prime, and then you squeeze it again and again and again and hope that the thing converges. And the key technical lemma is this. If I have a, I don't need separable, but anyway. To take a sequential quasi-central approximate unit for the ideal relative to A, then for any number between 0 and 1, any A in the big algebra A, if I multiply A by 1 minus delta un. The usual trick is 1 minus un. Okay? But I don't want to move it too much. So 1 minus delta un. Then, I don't know if the limit exists, but the lim sup of that is less than or equal to the max of the norm downstairs and 1 minus delta of the norm upstairs. So if you've already fixed the norm pretty well upstairs, you don't have to do so much to fix it better. False as heck is it's not quasi-central. Trivial prove if it's central. Okay. So, you guys seem to like technical things, so I'll just leave that up there. And I already described this, you just keep making it better and better and pray for convergence. Okay. And anyway, the result Once you saw how to do it for x almost commuting with x star and the norm of x being 1 or less, we saw how to do it for all kinds of things. Right? So we get, finally, a really fairly generic statement. If you take a variety in the non-commutative unit ball, you can get out of trouble because it can look like a disk. But if you fatten it a little bit by taking, don't take the null set of the polynomial, take the approximate null set. So you're softening up the relation, you're fattening the variety in a non-commutative way. Then you get lifting problems. So if you like, you can take this as a theorem about projective Feaster algebras. I stated in my book that projective Feaster algebras are extremely rare. No, they're not. They were just rare where I was looking. If you take a non-commutative star polynomial in R variables, homogeneous, I don't want a constant polynomial, so homogeneous of degree 1 or higher. They don't all have to be the same degree. Finitely many, I did it with one polynomial here. One polynomial of degree greater than 1. Then if I take the universal Feaster algebra generated by R elements, such that polynomial is less than or equal to epsilon, and to make sure it's a Feaster algebra, I stick it in a unit ball. Sum of the xj, xj stars is bounded, is less than or equal to something. Then that's projective. And if you don't like that, fine. These relations are liftable, just ignore that. If you have, and again, there's a star polynomial, non-commuting variables. You take it, and it almost holds downstairs, and you have some sort of restriction to a non-commutative, a row contraction, then you can lift it to a row contraction. Same relation, almost holding to the same amount. Okay. So finally, a really generic lifting problem. Okay. And anyway, I was bruised by what my co-author said, but I did in fact read my book, and there in the introduction is the question about alternative non-commutative unit balls, which we now can solve. They're not quite star polynomials, but we get a bunch of projective things like the universal row contraction in Feaster algebra. So we can define non-standard non-commutative unit balls. You get a continuous field of Feaster algebras. They're all non-commutative as of retract. And what we do is we just take universe Feaster algebra generated by a bunch of elements, x1 through xn, such that the xj, xj star to the p over 2, I can do that, they're positive then, is less than or equal to 1. I know that I had to fudge the fact that they weren't star polynomials, but we have the technology, we built it anyway. And then this one, if you like, it's a square. x1 through xn, each individually, is less than or equal to 1. Okay. So this is just closest you'll ever get to a free Feaster algebra generated by a bunch of contractions. By the way, you can make these all self-adjoint if you like. It's not the same theorem, but you decide to check that change the proof a little bit, and you can preserve self-adjoint. So it really is real algebraic geometry we're doing here. But it's the topology of certain types of semi-algebraic, non-commutative semi-algebraic sets. I'm not doing yet geometry for them. They're defined geometrically. They should have nice topology. We show in a certain case they do. Okay. So there are a whole bunch of different non-commutative unit balls. I told you that all invariants you can think of will be the same on both, on all of them. They're all like contractible with a vengeance, right? Absolute retract. So are they all the same? Are they all different? I think it's hard. Thank you.